Israel remains on high alert for retaliation after a top Hamas official was killed in an airstrike near Beirut.
From Hezbollah's perspective, they would rather that Beirut not look like Gaza does currently. And that doesn't mean that they don't seem forced to act in some way, and there probably will be some retaliation.
Plus, Japan is still reeling from Monday's massive earthquake.
While barefoot, I quickly came to this school, which is an evacuation center. I escaped to here, but there's no water, no blankets, and of course it's so cold.
And later, an update from Kyiv. And we'll have a look at why tensions are on the rise in the Horn of Africa. Today is Wednesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll check in on rescue and recovery efforts in Japan following Monday's earthquake in a few minutes. First, though, the Middle East. Iran says at least 103 people have been killed and scores more wounded in explosions during the commemoration for a prominent Iranian general who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in 2020. It comes a day after a blast widely blamed on Israel that killed a senior Hamas leader in Lebanon. As VOA's Lori London reports, it brings further concerns of a broader regional conflict as Israel remains on high alert.
The gathering near the gravesite of General Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guard's elite Quds Force, marked the fourth anniversary of his death as long lines of people gathered for the event in the southeastern city of Kerman. A senior Iranian official called the blast a terrorist attack. Israel is on high alert for an escalation with Hezbollah after Saleh Arouri, a senior Hamas leader, was killed in a strike in Beirut on Tuesday. That was widely blamed on Israel.
This is clearly fits with Israel's intent. I think that's in keeping with what we would expect Israeli actions to look like.
Dr. Raphael Cohen, senior policy analyst with the RAND Corporation, says there had already been significant fighting along the Israel-Lebanon border since October 8th.
For the most part, it's been contained to that border region. It hasn't spilled into Beirut proper. But even before this, there was a concern, if you talk to Israelis, that that border would grow increasingly hot. So there was already, before this strike, a good chance that that Lebanon border would grow increasingly intense. This is one step in that direction.
Arouri was the deputy of Hamas's supreme political leader and a key liaison with Hezbollah. The U.S. State Department had listed him as a terrorist and offered $5 million reward. Cohen says implications for the broader Middle East region are unclear.
I think from Hezbollah's perspective, they would rather that Beirut not look like Gaza does currently. And that doesn't mean that they don't seem forced to act in some way, and there probably will be some retaliation. But you can argue that there is still some element of deterrence that exists up.
In recent days, reports indicated that Hamas negotiators were willing to waive the condition of a final ceasefire in their ongoing talks with Israel for another hostage release. As to whether the killing of Arouri will put that in jeopardy?
In public, my guess is this is going to throw a wrench in that, at least for the short term. Over the long term, you can see this cutting both ways. On the one hand, Hamas leadership is not particularly happy with one of their own getting killed. On the other hand, the same Hamas leaders might also view it as they are next. So you can imagine a scenario where they have more of an incentive to cut some sort of deal, if only to save their own necks.
The United States has sought to prevent any widening of Israel's conflict in the Gaza Strip, including the deployment of two aircraft carriers and other military assets to the region. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected in the region this week. It will mark his fourth trip to the Middle East and fifth trip to Israel since the start of the war. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
Japan is still reeling from Monday's devastating earthquake. Reuters' Almond Lee has that story.
The death toll from Japan's massive New Year's Day earthquake rose to more than 60 on Wednesday, making it the country's deadliest since at least 2016. Japanese authorities rushed to deliver aid to survivors in Ishikawa Prefecture. The 7.6 magnitude quake crumbled houses, damaged infrastructure, and cut off remote areas from much-needed assistance. Freezing temperature and heavy rain forecast in the disaster-hit regions also raise fears of landslides, which might further hinder rescue efforts. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Wednesday called it a race against time.
We will increase the number of self-defense forces search and rescue teams from 1,000 to 2,000 and double the number of police and self-defense forces rescue dogs to strengthen the teams. We are putting lives first and making the utmost effort to rescue and save people.
Kishida added that the aircraft collision at a Tokyo airport had no impact on aid delivery and that authorities have secured various routes. These satellite images showed the extensive destruction in Ishikawa's coastal cities, including Wajima and Sutsu, which is close to the epicenter. The mayor of Sutsu, which is home to about 5,000 households, said 90% of houses may have been destroyed. Over in the town of Anamitsu, the gate of this traditional shrine was found collapsed after the quake. Local residents, meanwhile, stocked up on supplies, which a nearby drugstore was distributing for free. Survivors in the hard-hit city of Wajima said they were used to having minor quakes only, and nothing massive like this one.
That's Almond Lee of Reuters. Now we meet Cassio, a survivor of the quake. Cassio and other evacuees have spent nights in sports halls and school gymnasiums, commonly used as evacuation centers after Monday's magnitude 7.6 quake in western Japan, which has left more than 60 people dead. The AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
One evacuee in Suzu, Kasuo Kobatake, tells the Associated Press, "While barefoot, I quickly came to this school, which is an evacuation center. I escaped to here, but there's no water, no blankets, and of course it's so cold. So that night, on January the 1st, I only slept with a cushion, with his house now flat. Kobatake says he and his wife have nowhere to go. Rescue workers and canine units are searching urgently through rubble ahead of predicted bitter cold and heavy rain in what Japan's Prime Minister has called a race against time to save trapped citizens." I'm Charles de la Desma.
And now to the other disaster news in Japan. Police are examining whether a crash between an airliner and a smaller plane at a Tokyo airport may involve professional negligence, as media reported on Wednesday. Transportation authorities have begun to investigate the dramatic incident that killed at least five on one plane, but also saw hundreds of passengers escape the other burning aircraft to safety. Reuters' Diane To has that story.
Japanese authorities on Wednesday began inspecting the charred wreckage at a Tokyo airport for clues on why a jetliner collided with a small rescue plane the evening before, killing at least five people, with local media reporting that police are probing for possible professional negligence. All 379 people made a miraculous escape from the Japan Airlines Airbus A350, which erupted into flames after colliding with a Coast Guard turboprop as the jet landed at Haneda on Tuesday evening. Only one of the six crew survived on the Bombardier-8, which was on a mission to send aid to the country's west following Monday's deadly earthquake. A Japan Safety Transport Board official told reporters on Wednesday investigators had recovered the Dash 8's flight recorder but were not sure what data could be extracted from it. Sources say the regulators working on the investigation with French and British agencies where the A350 and its Rolls-Royce engines were built. Airbus said it was sending technical advisers to help with the probe. Separately, police say they've set up a special unit at the airport to examine the incident, but declined to comment on the report of a negligence probe. In a statement on Tuesday, Japan Airlines said its aircraft recognized and repeated the landing permission from air traffic control before approaching and touching down. According to air traffic control recordings, the jetliner was cleared to land just minutes before authorities say the collision took place. In an interview on Wednesday, airline passenger Aruto Iwama recalled the horror of the crash, saying he was scared to death.
I felt strong shaking at landing, and when I looked at the window, I saw sparks flying and burning. And then the plane stopped. In less than 1 minute, the cabin was full of smoke. Then the cabin attendant led us out, and we escaped via the slide.
Iwama credited the flight attendants for keeping control of the situation, saying that despite some screaming, people were mostly calm and waited for guidance to leave the plane. I think that's why we were able to escape smoothly, he said. This is the first significant accident involving the Airbus A350, Europe's premier twin-engined long-haul jet that entered service in 2015. It comes after a US-based safety group warned last month about the risk of runway collisions, or so-called incursions. The Flight Safety Foundation had called for global action to prevent a new uptick in runway incursions as skies become more congested.
That's Diane Toh of Reuters reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Tensions are on the rise between Ethiopia and Somalia. We'll find out why in a few minutes. Now to Kyiv. Ukraine survived the biggest drone and missile attack since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion over the past 5 days. The capital, Kyiv, suffered the most, and the Ukrainian military warns that new attacks are on the way. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details.
In the past 5 days, Russian forces have conducted two of the most massive drone and missile attacks since the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022. Kyiv, Kharkiv, Dnipro, Odessa, Lviv, Zaporizhia, and other cities were the targets of the attacks. Kyiv and Kharkiv were affected the most. As of January 3rd, after two attacks, more than 30 people were killed and more than 50 injured in Kyiv alone. The most damage is reported in the residential areas. The commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, reported that the Russians attacked civilian and critical infrastructure, industrial and military facilities. He also mentioned that the capital, Kyiv, was the main target. Ukrainian society is devastated by the attacks, but united to cope with the consequences. This is what Kyiv citizens who came to help those who lost their homes in the latest attack told VOA. Daria lives in Kyiv. I believe that the Ukrainian population cannot be intimidated by anything. Here now, I think more than 100 people came. I know that some even arrived from the Kyiv region to clean up. Someone brought tea in a thermos. I think they will not be able to intimidate us. They can attack, but they will not create fear, 100%. Her resolve is echoed by Nadia, also a resident of Kyiv. And it goes on and never ends. But when you think about the feelings of those guys who are at the front line, fighting in the frost, in the cold, in the rain, you think you are sleeping in a warm bed, even in the bathroom, but in your own home. And that's it, all the fatigue disappears, and you think what else you can do. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian military is preparing Ukrainian society for new attacks. Yuri Ignadze, spokesman of the Ukrainian Air Forces, said that Russia might theoretically need several days to prepare a new missile attack. He noted that the main issue is the missiles, how many Russia can afford to launch in the next attacks, and if Russia will be able to replenish its stock. The British Ministry of Defense believes that Russia has at least temporarily changed its approach to long-range strikes on Ukraine and has concentrated on its long-term defense capabilities. British analysts stated that from December 29, 2023, Russia increased the intensity of its long-range strikes on Ukraine. Its forces used a significant part of the stockpile of air-launched cruise and ballistic missiles accumulated in recent months. Recent strikes were most likely aimed primarily at Ukraine's defense industry, according to British intelligence. They mention that this contrasts with last winter's major attacks, which prioritized Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Meanwhile, Ukrainian energy officials did report some damage to the energy system and power supply difficulties caused by the recent attacks, However, they confirm this does not create a critical threat to the operation of the Ukrainian power system. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
There's new tension in the Horn of Africa as Ethiopia prepares to recognize the independence of Somaliland. Mogadishu, however, disagrees. I'm joined by Harun Maruf of VOA's Somali service.
Somaliland is in the northern tip of Somalia. Somaliland was colonized by Britain. The rest of Somalia was colonized by Italy. These two regions, when they gained independence in 1960, they joined up and they created the Somali Republic, as we know it today. Somaliland has been arguing for a long time that it voluntarily joined this union. And what happened was that in late 80s, there was heavy war between the government that was based in Mogadishu at the time and rebel groups that were based in Somaliland. And during this war, lots of human rights violations took place in the region. And Somaliland has decided in 1991, when that regime was overthrown, it's going to stand alone and not be part of Somalia, based on what has happened during the civil war. So that is how this conflict has developed. And now, more than 30 years later, after Somaliland said it's going to stand alone, it has been trying to gain international recognition for its secession, for its separation and divorce from Somalia. Somalia has been arguing that the country is united, Somaliland is part of Somalia, and it will not allow Somaliland to secede and go its own way.
Now, it seems that Somaliland took a giant step forward just a few days ago by granting Ethiopia access to one of the seaports in exchange for that international recognition.
That's right. On January 1st, 2024 this year, the president of Somaliland, Musa Bihi Abdi, and the prime minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, signed a memorandum of understanding in Addis Ababa. In that memorandum of understanding, Somaliland said it's going to lease 20 kilometers of sea to Ethiopia. In return, it's going to get recognition from Ethiopia, the recognition that it has been searching for more than 30 years. And Somaliland belief is that it's going to be a precedent and it's going to pave the way for other countries to join Ethiopia and recognize Somaliland. That is the hope.
Well, what has happened? Have other countries joined in? Has there been a reaction from other countries in the region?
So far, no other countries has declared or expressed intention to recognize Somaliland. Ethiopia, nonetheless, has not yet fully recognized Somaliland. It's going to be a ceremony to sign this memorandum of understanding into a full-fledged agreement in about a month. And at that time, Somaliland hopes Ethiopia will recognize Somaliland. The European Union, which is a big key player in Somalia, has urged Ethiopia to respect the territorial integrity and the sovereignty of Somalia. Somali president has been calling Egyptian leader and other Arab leaders to express Somali government dissatisfaction and rejection of this memorandum of understanding between Somaliland and Ethiopia. And Somalia is very strongly opposed to this.
Is there any risk of this breaking out into another civil war?
It has the potential of further conflict between Somalia and Ethiopia. Somalia and Ethiopia have troubled history because of the presence of colonial powers in the region. A region that is inhabited by Somalis has been handed over long ago to Ethiopia, and that is the eastern region of Ethiopia. And there has been wars between Somalia and Ethiopia, the last one being 1977, the famous Ogaden War. It was very deadly and costly war for both Somalia and Ethiopia. Somalia took over a very large chunk of eastern Ethiopia. Ethiopia counterattacked and drove Somalia away. But since 1991, when the former dictator of Somalia and the dictator of Ethiopia, Mohamed Siad Barre and Mengistu Haile Mariam, were toppled, the two governments have been coming closer and the relations have been improving for a long time. As we speak, Ethiopia has thousands of troops in Somalia, some of them serving as part of the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia, and some of them are stationed and fighting against Al-Shabaab based on bilateral agreement. So Ethiopia has troops in Somalia, but it also has very good relations with Somaliland. And this relation now is developing into something else, which is creating diplomatic tension in the region.
Haroon Maruf of VOA's Somali Service. Haroon, thank you for your reporting.
You're most welcome.
And finally today, a story that touches on two global crises, the Israel-Hamas war and poverty. Malawi's government is sending young people to work on Israeli farms during the conflict with Hamas. Critics say the program is shrouded in secrecy and has exposed unemployment issues in the country. Chimweme Pedatha reports from the capital, Lilongwe.
Young people line up in large numbers at registration centers like this one for recruitment under a program that gives Malawians opportunities to work on farms in Israel. They are hoping to join about 600 Malawians who have been airlifted to Israel through the agricultural program. A resident of Blantyre, the country's second largest city, 23-year-old Ruth Kanchunjuru, is ready for such an opportunity.
It's a lifetime opportunity. I wouldn't lose it because at some part of the country there is war.
As Israeli reservists have been called up for military service since the war with Hamas began in October, Malawi is not the only country Israel has been making labor exchange deals with to fill gaps created on farms. Kenya announced that it was sending 1,500 farm workers in December, and Israeli officials said recruitment is underway in Uganda and Tanzania. But the labor exchange program in Malawi isn't without critics. Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, accuses the government of secrecy on the deal. Michael Kayatsa, the vice chairperson for the rights group, says they want access to information on Israel's treatment of foreign workers.
That's why it's important that he details, you know, like issues of safety, issues of pay, issues of conditions of service, you know, should be clarified so that people can make informed, you know, decisions.
In the next 5 years, Malawi's labor ministry says it plans to send at least 5,000 people to work in Israel's farms, but the figure could go as high as 15,000. Youth and Society, or YAS, rights organization, has demanded a clear policy position on the program, says its executive director, Charles Kajolowega.
There are no guidelines at the moment that are facilitating or supporting the regulation of this labor export. And what is more worrying is that the government is looking at these young people as commercial tools.
Israeli Ambassador Michael Lotem recently told a local publication that the labor export will benefit the two countries. But as of December 2023, a memorandum of understanding is yet to be signed, according to Malawi government spokesperson Moses Kunkuyu.
I mean, the MOU that we have to also be a guiding document in as far as the operations of the agents on the ground are concerned. And young people get employment, they go to Israel and work, and people come in and they start criticizing that process.
Through the labor exchange program, Malawi's government says it anticipates generating foreign exchange as young people get jobs abroad. Chimweme Badata, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.